Now it's time to check up on the top stories of the week in national politics. President Trump has declassified documents relating to the ongoing Russia investigation. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation is still up in the air as the Senate decides how to proceed after a sexual assault allegation. Plus, the U.S. and China have exchanged billions of dollars in new tariffs in a growing trade dispute.
And our question for you this week, are you concerned about the impact of the growing trade dispute between the U.S. and China? Are you worried about paying more for consumer goods? Is your business or industry being affected by tariffs? Is this an issue that could sway your vote this fall? And do you support the president's trade strategy? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Ginger Gibson is a correspondent for Reuters. Ginger, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot going on this week. One we haven't talked about yet on this show is President Trump declassifying documents from the summer of 2017 related to the application for surveillance warrant of a Trump campaign advisor. They're not out here in the public yet. Can you give us an idea of what kind of documents we're talking about?
That's right. There are two types of documents, really, the president has declassified. He's declassified parts of an application to the FISA court to surveil Carter Page. And this was someone who was consulting with Trump's campaign and who the FBI believed was working with the Russians. Trump wants the reasons that the FBI gave for conducting that surveillance to become public. The second part, and that, let's add, that's really unprecedented. FISA applications have almost never been made public in any circumstance whatsoever. The second thing that he's asking is that text messages that are still in the control of the FBI that were sent by a number of FBI agents and personnel, including Orr, Comey, Stroke, and Page, two agents that talked and were conducting the Russia investigation early on, that we now know were having an affair, and have already been criticized for some of the text messages they sent in which they suggested they were going to be going after President Trump and his team. He wants those released as well. We have seen pieces of them, some of them redacted. The president has suggested that they should all go without redactions, although we are learning today that there is a continued debate inside the Department of Justice and the White House about removing some of the names in those documents.
Now, with these FISA documents, what's the argument from the administration and some of the president's congressional supporters about why they want these documents to come out?
They believe that if the public can read these documents, they'll agree with President Trump and his supporters in Congress that the investigation was started unfairly, that they used documents and information that they shouldn't have access to, that they were sort of out to get the president without real justification, and that they will be on their side. The president calls this investigation a witch hunt, and his hope is that the rest of the public will agree that it's a witch hunt if they're able to see these documents that were filed with the court.
And some Democrats in Congress have been saying, well, hold on, this is, I think, something like 20-ish pages out of 400 and some pages in this whole process, something on that order. What are we hearing from people who are disagreeing with this decision?
The Democrats have two criticisms of this decision. The first, like you said, is that this is only a tiny portion of the information that's available about this investigation and the details that are involved in this investigation, and that you would have to release all of it to get a full picture of what's going on, and that by selectively releasing just the parts that they think might look good for President Trump, that they don't really tell the full picture. The second one is that it's just too early in the process. FOIA and other public record laws protect from release documents that are part of an ongoing investigation. The logic there being that someone who's being investigated shouldn't necessarily know everything that law enforcement has on them, and that knowing that might change their behavior, might change their answers. And for that reason, historically, records that have to do with ongoing investigations have been kept secret until the investigation is over. And because the Mueller special investigation continues, Democrats argue that it would be best to keep them secret until the investigation is over.
So you mentioned there's still a process here. These aren't just going to be dumped out for the public. When do we start seeing at least parts of these two sets of documents?
President Trump has said that he wants them released before the election, which is the beginning of November, as have his supporters. But you're right, there is a debate being had about making sure that there isn't national security put in jeopardy during this process. So it could take days or weeks. We could also start to see legal objections to this. So far, there haven't been lawsuits filed to try to block them from doing so. But that is a possibility, as some of the president's critics could move to get a judge to intervene to conceal some of these documents because they're part of an ongoing investigation.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from Reuters, looking at some of the top national stories of the week. Moving on, Ginger, dueling tariffs back and forth, more of them this week and maybe more around the corner between the U.S. and China. Give us the latest on that back and forth.
That's right. The trade war was back in full swing this week. President Trump signing off on another $200 billion in tariffs on goods brought to the United States from China, and China responding with retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods that are sent to their country. There remains to be no end in sight to these two countries swapping tariffs, and it's really starting to cost the American consumer and business. Business tells me that they're feeling the pain, in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars in tariffs, and they might have no choice but to pass those costs on to the consumer.
We invited our callers at 800-642-1234 on the tariff issue. Adrian starts us off in Chicago. Adrian, hi.
Hey.
What did you want to bring up, Adrian?
Hey, yeah. So I cover real estate in Chicago, actually for Chicago Magazine. Just listening in, and this is something that, you know, I'm hearing from developers. You know, a lot of concern over the rising cost of building materials. And, you know, across the country, especially in major cities, we've seen values increase dramatically just in the last few years, particularly in really kind of hot corridors and neighborhoods in major cities. As, you know, the economy rebounds and infrastructure improvements are made. But, you know, with the rising cost of labor combined with, you know, the rising cost of building materials and coupled with mortgage rates that have been creeping up, you know, I just really wonder, and I think a lot of people are wondering right now, what's going to happen.
I'm going to jump in, Adrian, and get Ginger in on this. Now, Ginger, you've written very recently about business groups being concerned about part of what Adrian was talking about there, the cost of materials. He's talking about building materials. You write people, businesses, factories worried about the electronic components that they buy from China and assemble into other products. What are you hearing there?
That's right. The concern here is that the price of just so many things are going to increase. Building materials make it more expensive to make buildings, make housing prices more expensive, make commercial building prices more expensive, which makes it so that they get done slower, which puts everyone's housing prices to up. And there really are ripples through the economy that are felt even by imposing a tariff on a small handful of products, but we're talking about thousands and thousands of products. And businesses very concerned that the economic growth that the country has seen in the past year, what they say were big benefits from the tax legislation, could all be erased by these tariffs. So that if people start to lose their jobs, if companies start to spend less and hire less, then we quickly could be pushed into a recession.
We're talking to Ginger Gibson, correspondent for Reuters, looking at some of the top national political stories of the week. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Ginger Gibson is with us for our weekly look at top news stories out of Washington. She's a correspondent for Reuters.
One of those stories, back and forth tariffs between the U.S. and China. We invited your calls. Let's take another caller now. Ben is with us in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
Yeah, my thought is I support the tariffs, and it's because I believe there's kind of a ideological double standard in that, you know, China sends a lot of cheap goods to America, and they do that by having poor labor standards and poor environmental standards. And so to me, I'm okay with paying more because I don't support the way they do things. And I believe Democrats should recognize that too, that those products have an environmental cost to them.
Ben, thanks a lot for the call. And Ginger, I've talked to people, trade experts and others, who say, okay, maybe not the tariffs on Canada and Mexico and the European Union. China is a special case for some of the reasons Ben mentioned. They don't always play by the rules, some people say. Are people treating tariffs on China differently than maybe tariffs on other countries?
The China tariffs are much more complicated. Many businesses tell me that they support some efforts to rein in China, especially because they say they're stealing their intellectual property and that it's been a real problem. And that's the justification that President Trump has used to impose these tariffs. Furthermore, you talk about it from an ideological standpoint, that President Trump is much more in line with Democrats who have repeatedly in the past called for more protectionist trade positions, who have argued for tariffs to protect some American industries, and I think almost any other Republican president would probably have found a good deal of support in Democratic quarters for these tariffs. This Republican president hasn't made an effort to win over any Democrats or to work with any Democrats, and it's a little bit trickier on the political front for a number of reasons, but it is more complicated, and President Trump himself has said that these tariffs aren't permanent, or he doesn't want them to be permanent, and that the goal would be to negotiate with China to get them to embrace fairer standards, to stop stealing American intellectual property, and then he'll happily take the tariffs back down to zero.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to John in Green Bay. John, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. And in the meantime, the average person or the average business owner who is affected by these tariffs is just supposed to trust an administration that never gives any facts or details or proof or statistics of how long this is going to take, what's going to be the impact, how they're supposed to get through it. And it's really, to me, the biggest rub in this whole thing is the party of government get out of my face and out of my business is jamming this down people's throats, picking winners and losers. And then when a company like Harley-Davidson makes a business decision because of these tariffs, he throws them under the bus as them being somehow unpatriotic and not sticking with them. The fact is he never gives any proof or statistics, and he shoots from the hip. And he's not an economic genius that we can all get behind.
John, thanks for the call. Ginger, in your reporting, you wrote that a bunch of business groups aren't just sort of vaguely worried about this. There is, it looks like, going to be an effort, a new organization of businesses lobbying and advertising to the public on some of these very concerns that our caller just raised.
That's right. Business is very much in line with the caller just now. And when I talk to them, I often hear from lobbyists and from business trade group officials here in Washington that they can't figure out what the president's plan is. I think that's the biggest frustration. If they could figure out some type of end game or plan, if they thought they understood how he saw this playing out, I think business would be a lot more comfortable giving him some leeway and accepting the president's argument that there's some short-term pain for long-term gain. But they really feel that there isn't a plan, or at least not one that could be articulated to them. And for that reason, that's why we see business putting what is now millions of dollars into trying to raise concern among voters about these tariffs.
Thanks for your calls. We're talking to Ginger Gibson from Reuters, looking at some of the top news in national politics over the last week. Now a fast-moving story in the news, the confirmation of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. A sexual assault allegation came out. Testimony, some kind of hearing planned on Monday. It looks like Brett Kavanaugh, the nominee, is going to testify. But his accuser at this point, it seems up in the air. What's the latest on this, Ginger?
That's right. This is a very fast-moving story. There was some talk that Brett Kavanaugh wouldn't testify if his accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, did not also come forward to testify. What it appears to be conversations through her attorney, she seems to have been declining to interview until something more of an investigation is done. We're now hearing from Republicans that if she won't testify, whether in a public hearing or in a private hearing, that they're just going to move forward with voting on his confirmation. And we could take that to mean very likely that they would approve his confirmation, as they seemed on track to do before this story came out over the weekend. But I suspect Republicans are looking for a way to make it seem that they've given this accusation as much vetting as they can, and then looking for a way to get him confirmed as quickly as they can before the election.
Yeah, we heard Christine Blasey Ford, via her attorneys, had said she was willing to talk to the Senate. Republicans are saying, great, we've got this opportunity Monday or never appear to be the alternatives. Democrats saying, hold on, why is that particular day so important? There's a lot of wrangling about the when and how of when and how she would testify.
We've heard criticism from Democrats throughout the entire process that Republicans were moving too quickly. The calculation seemed to be that Republicans were trying to get a vote before the election to be able to go home to their base and say, look what we accomplished, look what Republicans can do when they're in charge. And Democrats were trying to get to their base by saying, look what we can make a lot of noise about, even if we can't stop it. But sending more Democrats will allow us to stop it. So the timing and the speed of all of this has been a point of debate the entire time, and this is now adding to it, with Republicans still wanting to move very quickly and Democrats trying to slow the process down, especially now in the wake of these allegations.
And you tweeted that political observers should be thinking about women going to the polls in November and whether they have the perception even that an accusation of sexual assault here was swept under the rug by one party. What are you watching for in the politics of this?
In the politics of this, I think that political observers in Washington and New York are making a grave mistake in underestimating just how angry women are across the country. I know when I talk to voters outside of the Beltway, I am just hearing an immense anger. And we've seen it so far at the polls and primaries and the number of women who have run for office and have turned out to volunteer and are trying to influence the system. I think voters, women voters particularly, were very unhappy with Donald Trump and the Access Hollywood video. And when he got elected, it sort of, they thought it wasn't possible. And then when it became possible, it created this anger. And this is only going to feed that anger. It is not going to subside it. If women think that a victim of sexual assault isn't being listened to, that she was being disregarded, that she was being not believed from the beginning, and that someone would get a job like this after having been accused of that. I think that we cannot underestimate how much anger is already out there and how much more anger this would add.
I want to touch briefly on another issue. Later in the show, we'll talk about a U.S. Senate opioid bill, actually a series of bills that were just passed in the Senate. You wrote earlier in the summer, this opioid addiction story, this is an issue for voters in a lot of places around the country.
It is. And we're seeing it in some of the hardest hit areas. It's been something voters have been talking about for a while. I wrote the story. I went to a district in New York in the winter, until it was snowing when I was there, and talked to voters who were wanting and demanding answers from elected officials. This epidemic has hit so many places in the heartland, in the Northeast, and voters want government to do something about it. This legislation now, I think, is an effort, but the criticism is it's not enough of an effort. It's not enough money. It's not enough research, and it's not enough treatment.
We'll have more on that legislation coming up in about half an hour. Ginger, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me.
Ginger Gibson is a correspondent for Reuters. She joined us for our weekly look at national politics. Still time for you to share your thoughts on any of the issues we just talked about and our question in particular about tariffs between the U.S. and China. What do you think? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know what you think. Running for any kind of office can be time-consuming, and if you're trying to get in front of voters statewide, it's more than a full-time job.
Our colleagues at WisContext wondered what that means when the candidate is already working for the state and people of Wisconsin as an elected official. Scott Gordon is the associate editor of WisContext, where you can find his article, What Keeps Walker and Evers from Campaigning on the Clock. Scott, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So every few years, politicians run either for re-election if they want to keep their job or run for a different office if they want to move into another position. That involves getting in front of voters. And depending on the office, it can involve a lot of campaigning. So are there restrictions on how much time people can spend trying to get elected if they hold a job, say, as governor or as superintendent of public instruction, as the two main candidates for governors do?
Yeah, that's something that we wanted to find out. And to draw a distinction here, there are pretty clear state and federal restrictions on using, you know, various government resources for campaigning, you know, phones, vehicles, you know, things that the public is paying for, obviously, are supposed to be kept separate from any kind of campaign activities. And if you're caught abusing them, that can lead to criminal charges and whatnot. But we were kind of looking specifically at the time aspect of this because we kind of figured, well, time is a resource, right? You know, these people are working on the public's dime, but also quite commonly seeking, you know, working on their reelection campaigns or seeking to get elected to another office. And we found that it's really mostly quite fluid. And, you know, as long as they're following those laws about resources and so forth, it's really more on the voters to make sure that they're spending enough time actually on the clock doing their government business.
So do we have a sense of how, kind of on a day-to-day basis, maybe it works? So Tony Evers, Democrat candidate for governor, Scott Walker, Republican candidate for governor, they each hold full-time, well-paid jobs with the state of Wisconsin and have a lot on their plate, you would presume. Do we have a sense of how they juggle that?
I guess I'm not really sure. You know, the thing is, people who have staff jobs in state government, legislative staffers, civil servants, people like us who are technically university system employees, you know, have some sets of rules to follow. For example, if you're a legislative staffer and you want to spend time working on a campaign, you know, you're supposed to take leaves of absence or vacation time and, you know, let the kind of management there know what you're doing, especially if you're doing stuff during the day. But for people who hold elected office, legislators, the governor, you know, attorney general, state superintendent, what have you, you know, the rules seem to be a lot more fluid. And it's interesting because we have a full-time legislature and we're, you know, considered a pretty small state to have one. But we still have legislators who, you know, still hold on to other jobs and aren't necessarily doing that as full-time work year round. So it does create a fluid situation. And I've definitely spoken with people in the process of this story who see a lot of potential there for abuse.
And are candidates required by either federal or Wisconsin law to keep track of how much time they're spending away from the job they're getting paid for to do campaigning?
You know, not that we could find. And it was an interesting story to work on because there was this constant process of reaching out to people and thinking, OK, I must be missing something, you know, as I'm doing this. But, you know, as I talked to various people who deal with election law, people who've been in office, you know, people who kind of work for good government advocacy groups, you know, I kept finding that there's really not a whole lot there to place those restrictions on those candidates. You know, obviously, if you're running for public office, it behooves you to be able to show people that you're, you know, actually doing the job. But it is an interesting situation, and it kind of feeds into this whole thing where people are always campaigning to a certain extent, and where there's such a need now to raise money for, you know, even state legislative races that it can become pretty time consuming.
So it sounds like, as far as you could tell, Scott, there's no requirement to keep track of how much time they're spending away from their day job as a public servant. Are there any limits to how much time they can be away from it, either federal or state?
Again, not that I could really figure out. And if there's some obscure law that I'm missing here, I'd really love to know about it because, like I said, this was a strange reporting project, kind of trying to find an answer to something a little bit elusive. So it really seems fluid. And it seems like there is this generally accepted idea that, okay, if you're an elected official, then a lot of things that you're doing are kind of inherently this mix of, your job, but also politics at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, if a legislator votes a certain way on a bill or whatever, there's clearly both like policy and political motivations bound up in that, perhaps. So there's a bit of a norm there. And I spoke to people who have different views on that. You know, I definitely had people say, well, this means that we have real self-starters running for office and we want those kinds of ambitious, driven people. You know, but I also had something say that this erodes the notion that elected officials are above all public servants.
It's interesting, I think, because with concerns about the effect of big money in politics, a lot of the concern, I think, stems from, is there undue influence being used by people who can give big donations to candidates? It seems that, as you said, the more time they have to spend campaigning and more frequently campaigning, that's taking more time away from the job that people wanted them to do by electing them.
Yeah, and especially in legislatures and Congress, this has been something that you know, that there's been more and more concerned about, especially in the era of Citizens United. And then, you know, in states, including Wisconsin, that have considerably loosened, you know, campaign finance restrictions.
We're talking with Scott Gordon. He's associate editor of WisContext, and we're looking at the issue of when someone who holds public office is running for either that office or for another job and how they split their time between campaigning and doing the job that they've been elected to do. And, you know, Scott, it sounds like it's kind of an honor system that they're doing their day job.
There is this element of an honor system. One of the folks I talked to, Jay Heck, you know, used that language when telling me about this. And, you know, he's got a point. You kind of have to trust that these folks are dividing up their time because in an appropriate way, because a legislator or the governor or Brad Schimmel or Tony Evers, they're not necessarily filling out a timesheet and submitting it to HR to make sure that they're, you know, doing what they're supposed to be doing at any given time of day. You know, and then the other thing is you kind of have to trust that if someone gets elected, they're going to stick it out for their term and, you know, try to do the things that they said they would do rather than using it as a stepping stone to get to somewhere else, which has also been an issue in the governor's race.
So that's a great point, because it is another, it's a common campaign promise that, you know, I want to be your governor or your state senator or whatever, and I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it to the best of my abilities, and spoken or unspoken is, and I'm going to do it for the whole term that you're electing me for. I think if candidates were more upfront and said, yeah, I'm really excited to be governor, but, you know, if I get tapped for something, you know, in the cabinet or something, it's going to be hard to say no. That's another aspect of this kind of honor system, isn't it? There's nothing keeping candidates in a position that they are elected to.
Right. And this has become a big issue around Scott Walker, of course, because the last time that he ran for re-election, you know, he was kind of pressed to promise that he wouldn't turn around and try to run for president because there was already so much speculation about it at the time. And he did finally kind of say, oh, I'm committed to this and made a pretty explicit promise. And then, of course, he did run around and go around and try to run for president. And that didn't last very long. But it's something that people have kind of brought up again in this campaign. Well, you know, what if he gets reelected and something crazy happens ahead of the 2020 elections to create another opening for him and other people who, with those kinds of ambitions? And there was a recent Politico story that delved into this a little bit, and it led to this very tense exchange between Walker and a reporter, where he kind of got in the reporter's face for asking the question, even though it's a pretty reasonable question, and said, "Well, are you asking Tony Evers that?" And then did kind of again reaffirm, like, "Oh, I plan to serve out my term, or we're committed to this, and we've worked very hard to run for governor, and so forth."
And I assume what he was referring to is that Tony Evers was elected as the state superintendent of public instruction. And here he is running for governor.
Yeah, not exactly the same thing. But that was one rebuttal that he had to that, yes.
Oh, and Scott, as we wrap up, are there any proposals you're aware of that might alter the system in a way that would ensure that candidates spend more time fulfilling the duties of their current office, or at least that voters would know how much time they are?
I'm really not aware, although there are still folks, including Jay Heck of Common Cause, who I mentioned, who advocate for Wisconsin to have a part-time legislature rather than a full-time one. They say that we're a pretty small state to have a full-time legislature, and you know the salary and kind of the perks of that might not be appropriate for the amount of work that they do.
Well, Scott, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
Scott Gordon is the associate editor of WisContext. You can find his article, What Keeps Walker and Evers from Campaigning on the Clock, at wiscontext.org.
Wisconsin has loads of beautiful cities, towns, and villages, but if you had to choose one to call the most picturesque, what would it be? Architectural Digest magazine recently weighed in by naming the prettiest towns in every state. The winner in Wisconsin was Bailey's Harbor on the Lake Michigan side of Door County.
Travel writer Kevin Revelinsky is known as the Mad Traveler. He's written 15 books, including Backroads and Byways of Wisconsin. He joined us recently to talk about some of Wisconsin's prettiest towns.
Well, there we have it. Architectural Digest says Bailey's Harbor is the state's prettiest. Tell us a little bit about Bailey's Harbor and the case that, yeah, it could be on that list.
Yeah, it certainly would qualify in any short list, I think, of beautiful towns in Wisconsin. As you said, it's on Lake Michigan. It's protected by sort of a crescent moon bay that faces to the south. So they do get the sunrise in the morning. It's located on Wisconsin 57. So the highway kind of goes right through town there, and it's lined with bed and breakfasts, you know, a few inns, good restaurants. You know, it's a tourist destination, but they like to call it the quiet side of the peninsula. If there is such a thing, it's a very busy place in summer. But yeah, I would say it's beautiful. And the article you mentioned said that they were rating things on rich in architecture and also a nature element. So I think the lake qualifies for that.
And then spreading out from Bailey's Harbor, I mean, there's a lot going on in Door County.
Right.
If people want that nearby scenery, even if it isn't quite in the town limits there.
Yeah, and just outside of town is Ridges Sanctuary, which is a really nice natural park for, you know, hiking. And they've got range lights, which is the duet of lighthouses. And also just north of there, Kena Island Lighthouse.
And do you think there are other places in Door County itself that might be at the top of people's lists?
I'm thinking Fish Creek was waking up a little bit annoyed by the article.
Right.
They're on the other side, you know?
I did see, I can't remember who it was, somebody else had a top 10 list of Wisconsin picturesque towns. Fish Creek was on that one.
Sure.
Bailey's Harbor wasn't. So I don't know if there's a feud brewing. Yeah,
or they're just taking turns. I don't know.
Right.
I mean, one of them gets the sunrise, one of them gets the sunset. You know, you can enjoy both. They're only about 10 minutes apart. So
now it's tough in Wisconsin, right? Because in some ways you're comparing apples and oranges. In addition to the architecture, which they were talking
right.
about, I mean, do you want a Lake Michigan view, a Green Bay view, Lake Superior, a river, the Mississippi River? There's
right.
like so many different ways to categorize Wisconsin's prettiest cities.
Yeah, and the other one that often gets mentioned is Bayfield, and that's on another Great Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you know, obviously very beautiful. But what about something like Mineral Point, which is not on a lake, but and not even in the middle of the forest, but it's an historical town. It's got old buildings, thriving art scene, restaurants, a brewery. You know, that certainly would qualify. Or New Glarus, you know, very beautiful Swiss-themed town. That's unusual, something that you don't see anywhere else in the state, really. Well, Monroe might argue with that, but okay.
Yeah, are there things that you look for? I mean, you've traveled a lot, obviously,
mm-hmm.
and you're writing not just with yourself in mind, but other people in mind.
Right.
But what are some of your favorite things? Like, when you are checking out a new community, what are some of the things you are looking for?
Yeah, I'm kind of nostalgic. I like an old downtown. I grew up in Marshfield, Wisconsin. They still have a lot of the downtown buildings are still in place. I love that sort of, it takes you back in time,
mm-hmm.
you know, and usually nowadays those are becoming filled with local shops and trying to bring back the, you know, the downtown in various places. There have been a few cities that I think are overlooked or maybe worthy of getting on these lists because you tend to see the same 5 or 10 cities or towns, rather. I think Ashland, Wisconsin, across the bay from Bayfield, has got a lot of potential. They've got those giant murals on all the buildings mm-hmm. that are starting to draw people, and they do still have that old downtown. Darlington, Darlington, Wisconsin. I don't know if that's on the tourist map, but they have got a really nice downtown, and they just got a new brewery that took over. It's a coffee shop/brewery, and it's in an old service station. And they've redone that to look like it would have been back in the day, and they've got
a lot of
you know, artifacts and antiques from that era that makes that just a stop all by itself. But a little, you know, Pecatonica River runs through town, Cheese Country Trail ends there, I think, so, or passes through at any rate. So a lot to be done in a tiny little town such as Darlington. Charming place, I would say.
Talking about the prettiest communities in Wisconsin, Kevin Revelinsky is with us. He's the author of a bunch of travel books, including Backroads and Byways of Wisconsin, Architectural Digest. Pick the prettiest community in every state. They say Bailey's Harbor here in Wisconsin. Paul is with us in Marshfield. Paul, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to nominate, Paul?
Well, I've never been to Bailey's Harbor. But I did drive through Cedarburg a couple times.
Cedarburg, yep. That makes frequently makes other lists.
What do you like there, Paul? What caught your eye?
Well, I mean, just the gorgeous downtown. There's, you know, there's a nice little brew pub set along the river there. So if that's your thing, you can sit and enjoy. You know, it's in an old, like, grist mill.
Yeah.
So you can sit and watch the water come down. You know, it's a nice sound, nice views, good beer. So if you like that, that's good. But just, it's a beautiful downtown.
It is nice. With the water flowing past, that really nice ambiance. And inside, they I think they have an old grist mill wheel, don't they, Paul?
Right there. Yeah. You just walk by. You can sit there and you can see the, you know, the water kind of comes down. It's diverted around from the dam and still in its natural how it would have been used 100 years ago. And you can see the water flow right in there.
That sounds cool. Paul, thanks for that. Him talking about that grist mill and you with restoring that service station, taking that older building and making a cool use out of it, but still respecting the history there.
Exactly. Rather than tearing everything down and starting over, a lot of people are, you know, chosen to revitalize places. I mean, you look at like Titletown up in Green Bay taking over a train station and then a canning factory. That's really neat. It's a good way to keep some character in the town while bringing something new to the scene.
Let's take another caller. Mike is on the line in Viroqua. Mike, hi.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. What do you want to nominate, Mike?
I want to nominate Coon Valley, Wisconsin.
Coon Valley.
All right. What do you like there?
The Coon Creek, the valleys. It's just a gorgeous place. It's like being in Switzerland.
Okay. Thanks, Mike, for the
Swiss
call.
Town.
Yeah, we've got a few of those, right?
Well, that whole area of the state, you know. Other places like Algoma on the lake is nice. They've got that red lighthouse that's out towards your sunrise setting. And a few older buildings there, a winery, a brewery.
Great. Thanks for the suggestion, Mike. We'll go to Stella on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Stella, hi.
Hi. I would like to nominate the town of Rural, R-U-R-A-L.
Right, not just rural Wisconsin in general. There is the town called Rural. Right. And what do you like about to that as a scenic town, Stella?
Well, I don't remember. I think it's on Highway 23, but I'm not sure. When we lived in Marion and went down to Madison, it was on the route down to Madison. And now you have to go off. It's been bypassed, but you have to go off it. What you do is you go in at one end of the town, and it drives along I think it's the Crystal River. I'm not sure of the name. Anyhow, it's along a river. The road runs along a river, and there's a beautiful park between the road and the river.
Ooh, nice.
And just trees overhanging and wonderful old Victorian houses along on the other side of the road. And some very... charming, like windmill, like Dutch type windmill figures in the park.
Stella, thanks a lot for that. Sound like anything else you encounter around the state, Kevin?
Well, gosh, the list is long. Elkhart Lake, I think, is another fine, beautiful destination with the resorts around that lake and the Road America. Lake Geneva. Of course. These are kind of obvious, though, aren't they?
Sure. That's okay, though. That's okay. I think we have time, Kevin, for one more call. Carol is with us in Chippewa Falls. Carol, hi.
Hi.
Hello.
And are you, what are you nominating, Carol?
Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin.
Chippewa Falls. Okay. And make the case just briefly.
Well, we've got Line and Kugel's Brewery here. We've got a really nice little Zoom Park in Irvine, and they just put up a new band shelter and stuff along the Tipple River, and it's just really pretty.
Sounds great, Carol. A river runs through it, seems to be the theme of a lot of these.
A lot of history and a great river, so...
One thing we haven't talked about is along the Mississippi River, and I'm a sucker for it. It's a different kind of architecture there, and the bluffs and the river. It's a winning combination for me. Any favorites for you?
Potosi.
Potosi, I haven't been there.
The home of the National Brewery Museum, and allegedly the longest main street in the United States. It kind of just curls through the bluffs there down to the, just about to the river. I think it's a neat place and certainly a destination. It's got the visitor center for the Great River Road. And the National Brewery Museum and the brewery itself. So,
and just our last few moments, sounds like you'd make the case for us to stop by and check out that downtown instead of just bypassing it.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll leave it there, Kevin. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kevin Revelinsky, also known as the Mad Traveler. His books include Backroads and Byways of Wisconsin. He joined us last month to talk about some of the prettiest towns around the state.
And you can keep the conversation going. What's your choice for the prettiest town in Wisconsin? Whether it's your hometown or somewhere you visited, which place has impressed you the most? What makes it scenic and special? You can let us know and tell us what you like about it. Send us a photo by tweeting us at Central Time at WPR. We'd love to see it.
Feast your eyes upon this, mateys. There's more than one way to live forever. Gents, I give you the Fountain of Youth.
Scene there from one of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, reminding us that today, for some reason, is Talk Like a Pirate Day. We had an R. We had a mateys. A Feast Your Eyes, I think, is a good classic one, too.
And there were the waves in the background that added to the ambiance.
Exactly. Yeah. We have not yet talked like pirates around the studio today.
I'm really bad at doing any kind of voices.
Yeah, I'm bad at accents or pirate language. And I tried to play on Milwaukee.com. They had a fun feature about how to eat like a pirate, but they also had a Milwaukee pirate name generator. Where it's based on the first letter, your middle name, your birth date, and blah, blah, blah. I tried mine. It's actually, I can't actually say it on the air.
Would the FCC not be happy about it?
It's pretty borderline. So I'm not even going to play. I don't know. Talk Like a Pirate Day has been kind of a bust for me.
I know that May 4th is Star Wars Day.
Yeah, May the 4th be with you.
But do we know why September 19th?
I have no idea. And I didn't do any research on it.
Rob, I rely on you for things like that.
Compelling radio. Arr, this be Central Time. Me hearties.